in Mark chapter 8, as he does in Matthew chapter 16, when Peter expresses Jesus' true identity as the Messiah, it's at this very point that Jesus begins to talk in specific terms what discipleship is all about. I like John's heading, actually, in John's Bible, because this really is the first time that Jesus begins to reveal or begins to prophesy about what discipleship is. It is directly related to the cross. Disciples are called upon to die in order to live. One of the great paradoxes of our faith is this very concept right here. In the letters, as we find this concept expressed, dying becomes the metaphor for ceasing to sin. It becomes the metaphor for not living for yourself, but living for God, turning one's life around and living according to the will of God. It is, in fact, life transforming. It changes the way we do things. It changes our morality. It changes who we are. It changes the direction of our lives. We aren't necessarily called upon to run off to a mountaintop as a result of this and give up everything. But we are called to transform everything we are and have in order to bring them and those things in line with the will of God. That's the dying and living that Jesus is talking about. What appears to us at first blush, perhaps, or at first a thought, and in the mind of many people, restrictive, is actually very empowering. Discipleship unhinges us from the self-centered desires and channels those desires toward God. It takes what is our human nature and makes something positive out of it. It puts us thus in line with the will of God when we die to ourselves and live for God. And I'd like for us to talk about that today in three areas, because I think sometimes we abuse this whole notion of dying to yourself and giving up things and so forth. Take a look at them in three areas. One, a competition, money, and fame. And I'm going to try to define those ideas as we go through. But I want to see how discipleship plays a role in those things and how it changes those things, actually, and uses them perhaps for good and for God. And we do indeed want to look at them in the context of discipleship, as is explained here in Mark chapter 8 and verse 35. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. I want you to see that as transformation. I want you to see that as now living for God and not just for self, as we talked about somewhat in class this morning. That was a very important concept. The first issue I want to talk about is competition. To compete or not. Competition is somewhat the way of the world, isn't it? I saw a cartoon a number of years ago that expressed basically this question. What might hockey look like in heaven? You know, can you imagine the guys running into each other and, you know, throwing elbows and hitting with sticks? Oh, I'm sorry. I really didn't mean to do that. If I interrupted your, you know, ability to make that best shot, then I apologize and I'll stand out of the way. You know, just imagine those guys doing that. Or football. You know, would even football be played in heaven? Now, I'm saying this as a big football fan here, okay? So, you know that I'm kind of trying to think this through. Would it even be played the way it's played? Would it be something more like flag football? You just have to, you know, stop the guy. I'm not sure. But does discipleship remove the entire concept of competition from our minds at all? Maybe in certain places it does, but I want you to think about what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. And I want you to see how Paul at least find something redeeming about this concept. Paul uses athletics for a metaphor for what our spiritual life is all about. Do you not know, he says, that in a race, all runners compete, but only one receives the prize. And so run that you may obtain it. Compete, Paul says. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air. But I discipline my body and I keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself might be disqualified. Paul uses competition. He directs it in a very specific way against evil. One of the more interesting definitions in the Old Testament is the word we translate as Satan. In the Hebrew, it's Satan. So we just transliterate it over into English. But if you take that word in some concepts, it's not necessarily meant to be a proper noun or a name. It is the word adversary. Satan is an adversary. And by very definition, you compete with an adversary. So at least in some way, the whole idea of competition is sort of inherent in just the nature of our world. Maybe it's the nature of a fallen world that we have to deal with, but we are competing against something. You see, denying ourselves doesn't take away the idea of competition. It directs it in the right way. When we deny ourselves and take up our cross and follow Jesus, we realize, well, we're not just competing against each other, but we are competing against God. Goodness, we've been talking about in James so much the last couple of weeks. In fact, last week we talked about the idea in James 3:16 about the problem of selfish ambition. In fact, James even says it's demonic. It's not the kind of approach that we have to make toward one another. It's not what we're trying to do. But we are, in fact, in a battle. We're in a battle against an adversary. And so we have to learn to compete and compete the right way with the right tools. Now, it's kind of interesting what Paul says in a couple of places as well that seem to at least sound like, I don't know if I want to call it some mild form of competition. In Romans chapter 12, verse 10, he says, outdo one another in showing honor. You know, outdo one another. I mean, that's competitive language. Look at how he directs it. Outdo one another in showing honor. Very consistent with Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3, where he says, consider others more important than yourself. You know, there's at least an implied notion here that we are comparing ourselves to somebody else. And I realize we could turn this into a competition over who's the most humble, you know, which sort of defeats the whole purpose of the idea, you know, and I'm sure that's not what the Apostle Paul has in mind. But you see, he's at least trying to generate some sense of, here's the direction that our lives should take. If you're going to compete with each other, at least outdo one another in showing honor to one another. Maybe that's a healthy competition. I'm sure you can go take that a little bit too far. But if you read 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 8, he does the same thing when he's trying to spur the Corinthians on to finish the benevolent work that they started. What does he do? He says, well, I want to tell you about the Macedonian churches. So he at least is sort of seems to be, and if you go back and look at verse 8 in particular there, he seems to be at least using another church's work to motivate them to get them back on track to finish the job that they had started. Is that competition? Well, it certainly isn't the selfish competition that James is talking about. But there is something about competition that maybe we just need to kind of see it in the right way. And, you know, it's not a matter of, well, we'll give more than they did, or, you know, we did a better job than they did. I'm sure that's not the Apostle Paul's intent. But, you know, there's just some kind of way of channeling our impulses in the proper direction toward God in his will that may be a little bit of what's going on here. The command to die to self is a command to use what we have for the good of God. Competition. Think about it. How about the concept of money? And we're going to throw in a word here which we usually associate with money, and that's the word greed. You know, I think we can all agree that money is a moral issue. The Bible makes that very clear. How we handle money is a moral issue. It's where we get the concept of stewardship from. It's very important how we handle the things that God has given to us. Colossians chapter 3, we start at 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10. Paul says, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And often, you know, you'll hear that phrase quoted by people who perhaps for one reason or another don't think the idea of money is a good thing, or, you know, they want more of it, but money is the root of all evil. That's not what it says. It says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Money is, if you want to think of it this way, it's sort of a necessary evil. I'm not even sure it's evil. I'm sure the way we look at it and use it is evil. And that's what the New Testament is trying to get us to see. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5 calls your translation, some of your translations will say greed, which is idolatry. And that's an interesting translation there, because the word is actually the word covetousness. And the reason I would like for us to, today to kind of see that word as covetousness rather than greed is because of what we associate with greed today. Greed is usually the other guy. You know, the other guy is greedy. I just have some needs, okay? And it usually is put in context of evil corporations, okay? Bad capitalism, or, you know, even the, or, you know, whatever you want to say. Somebody else is greedy. And so, but if you think about the word covetousness here, I don't think you can do that as easily and say, well, it's always the other guy. It's always everybody else. All right? So we need to think about what Paul is saying. Covetousness is idolatry. And covetousness is basically the ninth commandment. Okay? Don't covet your neighbor's goods and his wife, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe the tenth. I'm probably even getting it wrong here. I didn't always memorize those very well because I'm not good at memorizing. But it's in there. I can guarantee it. It's one of those two. And, you know, how do we deal with this idea of covetousness and greed? It's very, very interesting the way this can be applied in a society as a whole. I read recently that a very famous economist who was basically a free market proponent, Milton Friedman, he won all kinds of awards for his theories of economics. He was asked one time on the Phil Donahue show, and I'm old enough to remember Phil Donahue. Okay, it wasn't that long ago, by the way, but he was on TV, and he asked Milton Friedman, well, how can you be a free market economist when there's so much greed in capitalism and in big businesses? And his answer was really very simple. He says, okay, well, tell me how you get the greed out of the government, and why that having a big government is a better solution than having, you know, big business. Greed is universal. You can't just blame somebody else for being greedy and say, well, if we only do it this way, we'll get greed out of it. We don't. The only way you get greed out of somebody's life is by turning them to Christ. That's the only way. We don't set up another structure that we assume will not be greedy. Take a look at, you know, what happens. The next time you hear politicians whine and moan and groan about cutting back on spending, I want you to realize here's exactly what they're saying. There's something that Congress calls baseline budgeting. Okay. Now, what they do is when they set up a program, they set up for every year, there will be a certain increase every year. And let's just say it's 3%. In other words, whatever program they have this year, next year it will increase by 3%. And the next year it will increase by 3% on top of that. Again, that's just I'm not sure if it's 3%, but it may be other percentages. That's the baseline. The increase is the baseline. And when people come along and say, well, we're not going to increase it by as much, in other words, we'll say next year it will only increase by 2%, everybody says, well, that's cutting spending. It's not cutting spending, it's cutting the amount of increase. You see, but that's the way they get around saying we're just cutting things. If you had in your own particular household said, you know, we can't go out to eat as much. You know, next year, we're not going to go out to eat at all because we can't afford it. That's cutting spending. That's not cutting the increase. Well, it could be cutting the increase. Well, we'll only go out to eat once a week rather than three or four times a week. But the fact is, you have to cut that spending. And you see, that's the way sometimes we do things ourselves. Rich people are not the only ones that are covetous. Blue-collar covetousness is still covetousness. You and I are subject to that like anybody else is. And we have to be very careful that we don't just demonize a certain group as they're the greedy, covetous ones. It's us as well. And we have to be very careful. How does discipleship affect the impulse for covetousness? Well, certainly we'd have to look and say, are we just jealous? Is that why we covet what somebody else has? Or that why we're angry at somebody else because they have more than we do? That's covetousness. There's jealousy involved in all that. Now, I want you to listen very carefully what the Apostle Paul tells the rich, because I think this is very telling. I could probably make us all and myself feel very guilty for not being like the rich young ruler. Or I should say, for being like the rich young ruler. You know, Jesus tells the rich young ruler, I want you to go sell everything you have. Well, if that's the format, then every one of us is living in sin. I'm sorry, we're living in sin. We have to go sell everything we have and then just follow Jesus. Would that mean go live in a monastery? Would that mean go off and live somewhere in a commune? Some people have interpreted it that way. And every one of us, whether we like to admit it or not, we are benefiting from living in a free market enterprise system. You're living off of that. So, you know, either we're going to reconcile ourselves to it, or we're going to figure out to do something what I think Paul is saying to do. And I think here's what Paul tells the wealthy. He says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. And then he goes on to tell them several things. First of all, he never tells them, get rid of everything. He never tells them that. What Paul says is, use it for good, be generous, and don't put your trust in wealth. Use your wealth on behalf of Jesus Christ. Now, I think that passage is probably a really, really good indication of what Jesus means by discipleship. You take your desires and what you have and all that you are, and you die to those things and you use them for God, not just for yourself. Okay? You use them for God, not just for yourself. That's what we call stewardship. It's taking what God has given you and using it in a good way. We call it discipleship. We call it stewardship. Should we discourage those who have the talent for making money from making it? I've known of some people who said, I really feel like my talent is making money. And you think about how they might be able to use that for good. There's an article that you should take a look at, which I think was a really interesting article, on the Christian Chronicles website. It probably will come out in the next issue of the Christian Chronicle. But it was a story about a church in Atlanta and a particular person who was an elder in that church died suddenly this past summer of a heart attack. He was only 60 years old. And this individual happened to be the vice president of public relations of Chick-fil-A. Member of the church, member of the Church of Christ in Atlanta. Vice President of Public Relations of Chick-fil-A. I wouldn't be surprised if all the tension involved in what happened over the last summer might have been part of the reason why this it got to this guy. I mean, who knows, man? I really don't know what the problem was. But he had a heart attack. Now, interestingly enough, Chick-fil-A had been, at one point, had already set in their budget to donate $250,000 to this church to help their building fund. Well, because this particular individual died and he was an employee of Chick-fil-A, they quadrupled it. They gave them $1 million for the fund to help their church improvements. Now, you know, maybe the rest of us are thinking, gosh, do we have anybody like that? You know, do we know anybody like that that might help us? But I want you to think about this. I don't know that Chick-fil-A, when they started the business, they intended, I'm going to make a gazillion dollars. Maybe they did. But I want you to think about some of the businesses that generate that kind of money and that give that kind of money to organizations through their own charitable foundations. You know, a lot of these places, they put together charitable foundations and they give money to, I think Dave Thomas from Wendy's, when he was alive, he was actually an adopted child. So one of the things that he did was to put together a foundation to promote adoptions. And the company gives tons of money for people who want to adopt. Where would we be had we not had people like that? You know, if we don't celebrate people who can make money and are generous with it and encourage them to be generous with it, you know, do we really have money available for things? I don't know. I think people like that, they have seen, rather than greed as being their motivation, having gratitude as their motivation. And that's really transformation, isn't it? People who have money, if they're grateful, if they learn to be grateful for what God has given them, then they're able to give it to other people. And that's what Christianity does. That's why this whole idea of discipleship applies so well to the whole money thing. It doesn't necessarily say don't make money. It says use what you have for the glory of God. That's what he calls all of us to do. We are stewards of what God has given us. Not of what we've done for ourselves, but of what God has given to us. We have to allow some way to unleash human potential. And I think there are ways that can do that without saying, you know, you're bad because you have money. How about the whole notion of fame? And I'm going to throw in a word here, success. This is the third pillar of what I would like to say today, or at least address in discipleship. I don't know about you, but I get a little bit unbothered by the fact that there are so many programs and shows, really a proliferation of shows, that offer and dangle this carrot of fame in front of everyone. You know, the American Idol things, The Voice, and all the ones that say, come on this show and we'll make you famous. Now, I'm not one that believes that it's wrong to have singers and people do those kind of things, but because they've proliferated so much that it's like, well, yeah, this is the highest good. Being famous is the highest good. Yeah, I kind of wonder how many people really believe that. Appeals to dreams of being famous is really what drives them to be on the show. And the number of shows that there are leads me to believe that there are way too many people who have placed fame as the zenith for all that is good and right. And maybe we confuse that with success. I'm not sure. First of all, I ask the question, do I really want all that attention? You know, do I want my privacy invaded to that degree that it will? Do I want cameras following me everywhere I go? I personally would not want that. You know, you have no privacy anymore. I mean, go all the way back. You know, Elvis Presley, he couldn't go out of the house during the day. Whenever he went out at night. Or, you know, whenever he went to some local theme park, he would buy the whole park for the night. He would buy out all the tickets just so he could go and ride the roller coaster. Okay? Do you really want all that? That's perhaps another issue. But let's think about the idea of success here. Is success an evil, therefore, to be avoided? Is success a measure of faithfulness? How do we measure success? Those are all legitimate questions that I think we should ask. But let's look at this from the beginning of the process rather than the end of the process. And by that I mean, let's go back and think about what motivates us. The parable of the talents in Matthew chapter 25, verses 14 through 30. In that parable, Jesus, the master, gives something to everyone. Some he gives more than others, which is sort of a little bit of a paradox, or it's kind of odd that he gives some more than others, but that's what he does. Does the master expect each person to put forth his best effort? You know the answer to that question. That's a rhetorical question. He does expect them to put forth their best effort. And when the five-talent man comes back with five talents, he says, well done. When the two-talent man comes back and he only has two, he says, well done. When the one-talent man comes back and he doesn't even have one more, what does Jesus say? What does the master say to him? Would the one talent servant have been condemned had he at least put the money where it could have gained something? And you know the answer to that as well. No, he would not have been condemned. He at least would have tried. Why was he called wicked, slothful, and worthless? You know the answer to that question as well. Discipleship demands that we use what God has given us. And if we succeed, so much the better. If we try and fail, that's probably okay as well. We have put forth the effort. And, you know, maybe that's the whole concept of success. Maybe we should replace it with excellence. You know, when Paul tells people in the book of Colossians that for them, you know, to just whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Do it as if you're working for God. That to me sounds like he's saying you do the best job that you can do because you're not working for anybody else but God. That's the ultimate master you're working for. You are expected to be responsible with what you've been given. And you know what? It helps build a certain something in the society that looks good, doesn't it? It actually builds into society, you know, people saying we're gonna do what's good for everybody. I'm gonna do what my employer wants me to do, and I'm gonna do it well because that's what God expects. That's a definition of success we can live with, isn't it? That's a definition of fame. If you want to use the word fame here, we become famous or become known for doing the right thing and doing it to the best of our God-given abilities. We have a responsibility to do that. We're not just talking about a right, we're talking about a responsibility in the eyes of God. And once again, you see, it's discipleship that demands that from us. It demands that our talents, time, and resources should be used on behalf of the kingdom of God. And when you do the best job you can do, you are a witness for the kingdom of God. You're saying to people around you, I'm going to do what's best. I'm going to use my talents because that's what God expects me to do. This is a part of being in the kingdom of God. And I think that's what means to die to self. We would rather do what's right for the person we're working for than just for ourselves. Than just because we want to take from them or just want to kind of get away with doing the least amount that we can do. That's not success. It certainly isn't excellence, and I would suggest it certainly is not discipleship. God calls upon us to die to ourselves and live for his sake. It demands that we become different in our approach to all of these things. We are transformed by the gospel. We die to the old ways and we live for Christ. Whatever we've been given by God, talents, money, resources, are meant to be now geared toward their usefulness in promoting the kingdom of God and being consistent in our lives with the will of God. That's what we do. That's what God calls to us. God owns all. We are mere stewards of his gifts, and they are to be used for him, not just for self. That's denial of self, taking up our cross, and living for him. And this is discipleship. That's what we want to practice. When we compete, we're competing against evil. And sometimes that evil is in our own hearts. When we look at our money, we're trying to determine how we can best use the resources that God has given to us, be it to give to our families and make sure they get what they need, be it to give to the church, be it to give to any charitable organization. We're using the money God has given us, and it can be used for good if our lives are transformed in the process. And success, how about thinking this week in everything you do that you're less worried about success and just concerned about doing it the best you can, striving for excellence. And in our church, we strive to do it the best we can do. We strive for excellence because that's what God calls us. God has given us things. Let's use them in the best way that we can, knowing that God demands that from us. Practice it every day this week. And think about how discipleship can be a real good part of your life and a witness to God living in your life this week.